Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 20th, the year 2002, and Jeff Kersengrip continues his series, Communicating Across Cultures. This is session number 5, entitled, How to Develop Intercultural Relationships. This is tape number KGJ 2002-05. Now let's join Jeff for this morning's discussion.
Good morning!
Good morning.
Now you've all been, I don't have to say anything about the series. You all know what we're up to. Today I want to focus on, from this general sense of what it means to be competent. Yesterday we talked about being motivated, having certain knowledge, certain attitudes, certain skills as being important to being interculturally a good navigator. But today I want to talk about how you can apply some of those things to interpersonal relationships, hoping that you buy even a little bit of the notion that it's important not just for you effectively interpersonally, but also that it's good for the social and political life of the community to welcome people from different boundaries, especially people who may otherwise feel marginalized. And I'm not arguing that we can entirely unmarginalize people by the way that you communicate with them, but that we can continue to marginalize people by the way we communicate with them, or don't. And I just think this has some real heft to it. This is important stuff. I'm convinced that you build a community one relationship at a time instead of trying to legislate top down. Legislators seem to just respond to things that are happening in the world, so we'll see what we can get going. I want to talk today about, first of all, just what it means to have a friendship, and then find out something about your friendships and how you make them and how you see them differently when they become cross-cultural friendships, and then share some information about how cultures vary and how they regard strangers, and how individuals vary and how they regard strangers, and then get some advice about how to do things and solicit your advice about how to apply that. I sound like a teacher, don't I? Today I would like to... Yep, that's good. Okay.
No, I have a comment to make. We had the homeless men up a couple days ago. And
feels like a couple weeks.
Yeah, I actually don't have any problem with homeless people. I mean, I see them all the time, and but a couple of them smelled, and it was really hard for me. And so, the question in my head is, I can be welcoming with my spirit, but when something just really smells bad, it's really hard for me to be welcoming. And so it's like I just wanted to see how other people respond to that. I mean, you can handle a smell for a while.
But you wouldn't choose that person as a friend?
Well, to tell you the truth, well, definitely not. Unless I could say to the friend, I really want to be friends with you, but there's this thing that's preventing me
from. And you can't do that to lead off,
Yeah, you can only do it.
Barbara. I'd like to be your friend, but.
But yeah, right. Yeah, it's
you
so.
Could.
Well,
they wouldn't get you very
far. right. But is everybody similar to me, or am I just really different in the fact that I'm just really sensitive to smells?
Well, let me turn this into a question. What sorts of things do you find really as roadblocks to starting new friendships? I'm going to ask the question more positively later, but what are the things that block you? For you, it may be people who smell a certain way, that's a particular block. What are some other things that get in the way?
Blatant rudeness.
To other people or to you?
Either one, I think.
Okay. That's a hard one for me. Black and white thinking is one of mine. I think I mentioned that yesterday. I feel somebody being really dogmatic about things, even if I agree with them, I'm less tempted to be. That's a block for me.
If there's some cultural behavior that I interpret as anger or aggressiveness, kind of abrasive aggressiveness. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people really are angry, and that's one factor. Other times, I know I've encountered some cultural groups that have a way of talking that sounds clipped and angry to me, clipped and stern and angry. And I found myself, before it even dawned on me what I was doing, I found myself not liking these people, and I realized I was responding to how they spoke, how they pronounced
the word. Style thing.
Yeah, style thing. Yeah. So, but anyway, if I sense somebody's angry, then I get protective and defensive and judgmental and not liking them and stuff like that. Yeah,
another mind is sort of alpha male behavior, mm-hmm. where men are trying to meet other men just so they can exert dominance. I mean, it's a real prominent human need. But I don't necessarily want to be part of a friendship that helps to meet that need for them. And I don't want to compete with them. Yeah, it's not like I'm going to be a big test for them. I'm not interested. Believe it or not, we've actually studied friendship. We being the academic community, haven't actually done it myself. I just read with somebody else. But somebody tried to say, so what is a friend? And it's a more complex question than it may seem at first blush, that you think, well, I know who my friends are, but you know, the Supreme Court knows what pornography is too, but basically that's as defined as they could get it, is I know it when I see it. I recognize it when I feel it. But here are some of the ways that internationally now, worldwide, these are characteristics that associate with friendship. This is how people describe the people that are friends to them. First of all, that those people exhibit more helpful and supportive behaviors than fighting or avoidance behaviors. That if you're fighting or avoiding somebody a lot, they probably aren't someone you would call a friend. We ask for advice more than offer criticism in friend relationships. We offer intimate rather than role-governed actions among friends. Helicopter or truck?
Helicopter.
Okay. Overt visible behaviors more than covert hidden behaviors. This is the assumption here is that with our friends we're more disclosive. We share more than we keep hidden. And that if you find yourself hiding information from a person, that's a sign that perhaps you don't fit that category. Privacy is respected in friendships, and debts, favors, and compliments are repaid. These are universal. So even just having this level of knowledge about friendships helps people navigate across cultural boundaries. If you're trying to be a friend to someone in another culture, these are pretty safe ways to do it. Okay? If you go in offering criticism, avoiding them, behaving like a certain kind of American, keeping information hidden, you're probably pretty incompetent in trying to create a friendship with those people. A more interesting approach to friendship I find right below the line there is that this is true really of all relationships. It's called a dialectical approach to understanding relationships, and says that every relationship is fraught with these tensions, and that it's never a matter of resolving these tensions, but just managing them. And that being part of any committed relationship, committed friendship, committed romantic relationship, relationship with children, has everything to do with wrestling with these particular, they're called polarities or dialectics. One is that we want to be interdependent with that person. Karen and Tony really want to be, you know, connected. But at the same time, they also want some independence. And that's, you know, something both parties wrestle with. And you aren't in the same spots at the same times, and yet it's something you always wrestle with. I want openness with Emily. I also want privacy from Emily. There's some things about Emily that I'm sure I don't know and shouldn't know. You know, those are her things. And there's some things about me I'm sure that she doesn't know. Same thing. And yet I would be really dissatisfied if that was all that held us together, was mutual privacy. Novelty and predictability. We like having pizza night, you know, on certain nights, or family movie night at certain times. But we also like to be surprised. We also like things to change within relationships. And the last one is really unique to intercultural relationships, and maybe that's a good starting point for today, is that when you're in a friendship with somebody from another culture, you want that friendship to have a mutually satisfying identity. You want that relationship to have its own identity that's satisfying for both parties. But at the same time, you don't want to give up your own individual cultural identity for the sake of that relational identity. You want to have both. Generally, you want to have both. You want to feel like you are the person you were before this relationship began, and yet you still want to have this relationship. And for many people, that's a real struggle. I read in the sports page about 3 weeks ago during Wimbledon, there was a column by the Oregonian sports columnist about, oh, it's a doubles team at Wimbledon with a Pakistani teamed with an Israeli. And they made it much further than anybody thought they would. So they kind of appeared on the international media radar. You know, hey, look at this. There's an Arab and an Israeli playing doubles together and doing very well. It was very interesting to hear them respond to the hubbub of how it was that they enjoy each other as people, which is why they decided to get together as a doubles team. But that describing some of other people's responses to them and how they've had to respond to those people's responses just to maintain and justify their even just a playing relationship. It was very interesting to read about, and it had everything to do with this. And how do we maintain a satisfying teamwork together, and at the same time keep on being Arabic, keep on being devoutly Israeli or Jewish? I just thought that was great. That was kind of fascinating. How did you get to know your friends and partners? I want to go in that direction. The people that you know best, if you could kind of generalize from those, how do you generally get to know your friends and partners? How did you find them in the first place?
I was at school.
Shared tasks too.
Okay, so shared role, perhaps you were both students when you say at school. Shared tasks?
Yeah. I met Tony when we were both making music for the folk liturgy where we were undergraduates.
Okay.
We've been making beautiful music together ever since.
Oh, that was the expected eye roll. That's very good. Okay, so doing things, finding yourself in a similar role to someone, maybe talking about sharing that role, doing some consciousness raising together. How else?
And shared problem solve.
Okay.
Working together, actually.
Through crisis.
How are we going to handle this? How are we going to do that?
Wonderful. Yeah, working through crisis together. Yeah, everybody thinks they're obligated to speak now because it's only six people.
It's great, isn't it?
It's very nice, actually.
I think once in a while, I mean, you do meet people just very unexpectedly in a random way. Although it's always hard to know how to strike up a conversation with that person. But so I think most of my friends, and certainly with Barbara, we met, there was some sort of a shared community that existed before we met each other. In other words, we went through some mutual friends.
Okay.
For us, it was both problematical and helpful that we were from Lutheran families and children of Lutheran clergy.
Are you both PKs?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're still together. Sorry.
Years of therapy later, we're still together. But I mean, nevertheless, there is a certain familiarity, and it brings with it problems. But there is a familiarity that helps, can help, as opposed to meeting someone on the bus.
And recognize that how much this is the first one of these sort of meeting strategies that would be characteristic of a country other than America, or other than a real low-context culture like America, where you would kind of make your own connections with people. You do things together. You volunteer for the same kinds of events. Here it was other people we had in common kind of put us together. And that's very common, in that your relationships would be proscribed and prescribed by where you are in cultural hierarchy and who's there with you. But even up to the level of arranged marriages in some cultures, that, you know, that's not a matter of free will, that's a matter of societal connection. So friendship in America is a much more self-directed endeavor than it is many other places, which I find really interesting, because there's, you know, there are rights that come with that and also real responsibilities. If it's largely on you, then, you know, there's a greater ethical stance that has to come with that. Whereas in other countries, there's an ethical culture that's built up around all this stuff, and all you have to do is you follow the rules, you know what they are, and they're easier. In our relationships, often we're making up rules as much as we're following them.
A marriage relationship is one thing, but friendships are another thing. And I think it's hard to make a friend and not be sort of intentional about it, or that people who have become my friends are people who I happen to see very often just as a matter of living, because being a wife and a mother and a person who works, it's really hard to be intentional about friendship if the person isn't in your life somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one for me. Something I noticed about my friends is that they're just people who somehow are in my life and accessible.
So that's one of your criteria for choosing?
No, it's not even a conscious criteria.
Right, but even looking back on it.
If I look back and look on time and energy, you know, how much time and energy I have, yeah, one of them definitely just is availability.
So what are some of
you rotate
those?
Your friends according to availability? Because I definitely do, and I wondered if I'm weird.
I don't have that many friends because I'm not that available. And I mean, it's just...
That's true for us.
It's a truth. You know, it's a sad truth, but I am just not that available. Mm-hmm. You know, till I work, till I be a mother, till I do the things that I do in my life, I have very little time and energy for someone outside my family, and I grieve that. You know, mm-hmm. I'm really sorry that's true.
Well, availability can come into play with intercultural friendships, too. I mean, how much access do we have to people from at least other national cultures? You really kind of have to put yourself in those situations to get them. Raising a daughter with a Mexican birth father, we feel sort of called to do some things with Hispanic culture, and it's really kind of hard to figure out how to gain entree. You know, where do you go to do that kind of stuff? So even if you're just looking back at your own friendships and relationships, what criteria do you apply as you're figuring out who you're going to be connected with? Availability sounds like one, that as you make sense of your own relationships, I guess availability maybe matters. How else do you choose friends?
The parents of your kids' friends.
Is that the same as availability?
Well, I suppose so, but...
I meant that as a question. I'm not saying that it is.
I've always had lots of friends, and every time we move, I practically forget those friends because it takes up so much time and energy with six kids and a husband and church and, you know, everything, my whole family that lives in Seattle, that carpools or, you know, whatever is how I've always done it, church.
So proximity is another.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Who's near you? Not only are they available, but, you know, close by people are more likely to be friends than far away people.
But how bad should you feel when you don't keep up with the people that you felt very close to? But there's no time.
I think that's an individual decision we make. Mm-hmm. I think in a high context culture, yeah, we do it, absolutely. In a high context culture where the social roles really matter, that would be a greater sin than in America, which is a very mobile culture, and that's more expected. That, oh, you know, we would totally understand that you would be so busy that you couldn't keep up. Whereas in Japan, they wouldn't totally understand. You know, you need to maintain those kind of bonds.
Good thing I live here.
I guess. So, proximity, availability.
Well, I was going to say, when we were in Germany for almost 4 years, coming back, we stopped to see relatives and friends from the East Coast to the West Coast. And I made a remark to my husband about, I was surprised at the number of people who simply quit responding to letters. And he said that his view of a lot of Americans is disposable friendships are the norm. And for me, the friends that I've made along the way that have remained lifelong friends have been people who have either been responsive to me in some way. I mean, it's like a shared friendship instead of one person carrying the relationship, mm-hmm. but also different common ground.
What do you mean?
Well, I have twins, so one friend I have in Vancouver was someone I met through the Twin Club.
Okay.
Another friend that I have, we have sons in the same class, and we finally met at the end of first grade, and it's like having a sister that I would never have known I could meet somebody that would have so many parallels.
Great. So I'm going to twist what you're saying here and say it sounds as though another criterion for friendship then are people with whom you have cultural similarities. That you would say, I share twin culture with this friend. I share this particular school culture with this friend. And that if you feel a real bond with that person, having covered a lot of ground together already just by navigating that culture together, that it wasn't that much more of a move to get together.
Well, it's interesting because the twin thing, when I quit going, one of the things my husband said was, he sensed my frustration in not being able to communicate with these or make a connection with the rest of the ladies was based on all we had in common was that we had twins. Nothing else would have brought us together.
Yeah, I have friendships like that too now that I'm thinking about it. Musical friendships and things, mm-hmm. People that I just get together to do music with. And it's been fun to watch and feel some of the musical friendships turn into family friendships.
Exactly.
But they come over to the house to rehearse and end up staying for dinner and playing with Sam. You know,
right.
But that's really a fun thing. One of the things that we do in our friendships, so we have these, what I want to show you here is that we have actual decision rules that we carry around with us, whether we are aware of implementing them or not. we're pretty consistent generally over time. We evolve over time too, but we're also pretty consistent over time in how we wind up with the people we wind up with. And that some of those patterns can be real culturally exclusive, that we can find ourselves dealing only with people who share our cultures rather than people who are across certain boundaries, except the people that we're sort of forced to deal with. These things, I want to come back to these for a minute and share some information about cultures. These things are really interesting to me in that there are various ways, there are four ways that we know about that people try and resolve these tensions, how we try and manage them. We don't resolve them, we try to manage them. One is, you could call it submission, actually, right here on the side, where if you've got divergent interests within the relationship, sometimes one partner just submerges her concerns to her partner's and says, you know, well, you know, Joe really likes to be really interdependent when we're out in public, so I do that for him. You know, we do a lot of public display of affection, even though it's not my preference. But we submit to that. So that's one way people deal with any of these tensions, is just to sort of give on it. And if it's important to the partner, sometimes they give. There's another, this is probably very common, where you compromise. Neither of you gets all of what you want. Rich really wants some independence. Barbara really wants some dependence, or some interdependence, not dependence. And so neither gets all of what they want. And that may be what you do. And the strategies can change over time, too. There's, that one's particular for this one. Forgetting one. Oh, that's right. Often you make it an explicit point of negotiation in your relationship and you come to consensus about how you're going to do it, instead of just quietly submitting to your partner or just assuming that both of you, neither of you is going to get all of what you want. We like to call this a lose-lose mindset. You know, neither of you will get all of what you want. It's to start with a win-win. You know, I want to feel this, you want to feel that. How can we arrange so that we both get to feel all of what we want, or that we both get to do that kind of stuff? And that's a much more intentional process, and as a result, it's actually much healthier for many relationships. It really does help. There's one that's particular to this one here. Some people do, and here I've forgotten the word again. Speaking of Saturday morning. Oh, yeah. Some people do what's called obliteration. To deal with this one. That they say, we will just do away with either culture. We will just make it unimportant to our relationship. We'll forget that I'm from Pakistan and you are from Israel, and we will just generate a new culture together. We are the tennis team, and we will do this and that and the other. We have friends who have done this with names, for example. I knew a couple people in college who got married and changed their last name from, I think they were Smith and Hallis, and they changed their name to Holden. They just invented a new name for themselves. So kind of disowning both family cultures and starting over. There's a scholar of the Book of John who lives up in Seattle named Wes Howard Brook. And he's married to, I think it's Maggie Smith Brook. And their son is named Evan Brook. So they invented a new name for their son, and then they took their son's last name on as a hyphen on their name instead of the other. But then when he goes off, he's kind of had their heritage, at least their name heritage, obliterated in both directions. So sometimes people choose to do that to resolve these sort of the tensions that can come from dealing especially with difficult cultural boundaries. I don't know that in either case there were especially difficult family histories driving these people, but you know, it's a choice they made. But that people are pretty predictable in how we choose to try and deal with these things. I want to say one more thing about submission, is that it doesn't mean that one party always submits to the other. It just means that the relationship mode is that either one party or the other gives in on one or more of these things. There are things that happen all the time. I just want to share some information about how cultures differ, things that you can expect, and then get much more concrete. I'm feeling like I'm just sort of floating around here this morning. So cultures vary in two important ways regarding relationships. One is cultures vary in their rules about strangers, how you should deal with strangers in cultures. Some cultures see strangers as potential relationships, and I would put America in this category, that it's appropriate that you would, if there's somebody new coming to your old church, for example, that the mode that you should adopt is that this person could potentially be a relationship for you or a friend for you, and you should get to know them, that that's an important part of being an American. But in other cultures, that stranger wouldn't be seen as a potential friend until long after introductions, often ritual introductions, and a long period of getting to know the other person or their family and their interconnections and their relationships and the context around the family. Only then would you become, it's like you circle each other for a while before it's seen as appropriate that you would even think of each other as friends. So cultures really vary in how you ought to regard strangers. And second, as I mentioned yesterday, cultures really vary in how much they use the context to communicate and how much they rely on words to communicate. America, we rely a lot on words. This same session being held in Asia among, and in a particular Asian culture, say Japan, among a purely Japanese audience with a Japanese teacher would have a lot less language in it. There would be a lot more understanding. And a lot less stuff that would have to be actually said out loud, because they would be competent communicators in their own culture. So our culture is called low context because we don't value the context very much. We really rely on words to say what needs to be said. In high context, we rely on much more subtle gestures and things to
Would that be because they are so much more homogeneous than we are, that they all understand the same thing? I mean, is that why there's so much more understanding?
There are much more.
Or are they just smarter?
No. They value it more. They're a much more collectivist culture. The saying in Japan is, it's the nail that sticks up that gets pounded down, so that it's the same as all the other nails. You don't make yourself stand out. And in a culture that really values seeming and being similar, you'd be a lot more aware of what's going on around you because you need to fit. That's an important cultural value there. Yeah, good question.
Another piece of that, though, is that that varies with social class in this country also. When I was in grad school in English 20-plus years ago, I taught in a special admissions program for bright but ill-prepared, it was basically kids from the projects in Chicago and East St. Louis. And one of the things that was... this is not always an either or. Sometimes you're trying to give people additional strategies so they can, in a different context, function in a different cultural and linguistic way. And this is the way we approached it. Coming from a black urban vernacular kind of a language and culture environment, it's a lot more contextual. And so you don't elaborate your whole idea. You do small parts of it and assume much more on the part of your audience. And that's a very productive way to function. It's very competent in your term in some contexts. And at the University of Illinois, when you're in class, that's not a competent way to function. And so part of the way we treated this was, here are survival skills you need to know to get through the university. And it's how you speak, what you say, all of that, it's not good or bad. We all talk differently. I'm a very, very informal person in the way I speak. That's not lack of ability or lack of skill. But we, in different contexts, we do different things. You have skills I don't have, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Here, let me help you learn some of the things that you will need to help get you through the university so that your professors will see how smart you are, so that your competence will not be disguised by your way of conveying it.
Nice phrase. Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so it was not, it took a lot of the, and 20 years ago, and more than that, there were a lot more people saying, well, those people are just stupid. They just, it's a lack of skill. It's not a different set of skills. The sort of verbal BSing, trading, verbal joking, which I started with some of that skill, and I learned a lot more of it from my students.
Yeah, you would.
I don't do the, you know, your mother wears army boots kind of thing. I mean, your mother, a lot of other worse things than that. But that was a playful way of connecting, and just a ton of fun, just a bunch of fun when it was within a context of respect and care, and some jockeying for power, but in a very limited context of you know, sort of display of skill, like you would do on a basketball court or something. You know, a display of expertise in like verbal improvisation almost. But that was one of the differences, one of the liabilities that those students had, and one of the areas of skill with it. What are you assuming? What else do you need to say before you say this idea so your audience knows what you're talking about? Because I'm speaking writing.
These were mostly lower socioeconomic class African-American kids.
And Hispanic.
And Hispanic.
And the occasional stray blonde white kid who had grown up in that culture and was really between.
Sure. Well, it's smart to recognize the playfulness that's inherent, especially in African-American culture, but also there's more masculinity going on in the Hispanic culture in the U.S. generally. But that's one of the things that's really off-putting for Anglo teachers about African-American kids, is you want to get them to quit acting up, when acting up is how you make your place in the culture.
It's like how I strut my stuff for you.
Right.
And in a...
Good phrase.
Yeah, but not in a destructive way.
No, it's just...
And when I would... jokingly banter in a gently power-laden way. One time I remember a kid I was handing out so they would know what their grades would be at the end of the term. This one kid who had worked so hard, he came in with such low writing ability, and he just worked so faithfully and consistently. End of the semester, he was doing B work, so he got a B for the course. And he was expecting to get a D at best. I remember him just, he saw this piece of paper and he just slid down in the chair. I can't do it right now, but he slid down in this, you know, the desk that has the arm thing in. I said, come on, Kevin, the rule in this classroom is two cheeks on the chair. And the classroom exploded. They just thought that was the funniest thing. Now I'm telling him, we're not done yet, you know, sit up straight, we're still here. But I recognized how strongly he felt. I mean, he was ecstatic. He was really fired up.
And that's what ecstatic looked like that day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it was real. It wasn't ambiguous at all.
I am so excited. I'm going to slide my butt right off this chair.
I know. I just like slid down. And like he's just going to slide out on the floor, you know. But it was an entirely playful and connected kind of a thing.
That's
you
great.
Know, I was a teacher and he was a student. Mm-hmm. And I could make a teacher put down a sit up straight, you know. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing. But what cracked me up was the relationship or the reaction of the other students in the classroom. Just thought that was the funniest thing that had ever come out of this teacher's mouth. You know, it was real uproarious, kind of a goofy.
Well, this is a nice bridge. There's a notion of competence in instruction or in relationship that makes it sound like it's a set of behaviors. That here are the things to do and say. Here's the way to move your body and the words to let come out of your mouth, and that will make you competent. And I've always looked at models like that and thought, you know, but I remember, and you can always think of negative case examples. You can think of times when you were tremendously motivated by a teacher who regularly kicked you, you know, who liked to come over and like pull your ear or something, or just things that you would never put on a list of desirable behaviors, you know. So I presented a paper, and this is what drives what I study. I study how to motivate students, and that you're not doing it necessarily. People don't do it the same way. Excellent teachers look a whole variety of ways. And I'm going to get to one of the keys to that, which is also, I think, a key to this relationship later on here in this session. But that it's not a matter of everybody acting the same. It's a matter of approaching it with goodwill, open heart, like you said, the positive... I think goodwill was the...
a positive affect in this thing.
Right, so that you can do it in a way that the person knows you mean well. Students will come up to turn in papers, or they'll be dissatisfied with their work or something, and I'll say, give me your wrist. You know, and you slap their wrist and they go sit down. It's this very satisfying kind of little encounter. But it's not something you would find in a behavioral list of, you know, here's how to motivate students, you know, hit them. It's not there. So this notion of competence that I want to talk about is more than behavioral. It's not just a matter of acting a certain way. Just as the same as the behavioral advice yesterday wasn't really behavioral. You know, one of the behaviors was show respect. Well, that, you know, behaviors show respect differently in different cultures. It's really the same in maintaining relationships as allies. Individuals, so cultures vary in these two areas. One is how they regard strangers. The other is how much they let the context speak and how much you are expected to speak to make meaning within that relationship. Individuals also vary in that we're doing two processes all the time. I'm avowing a certain identity for myself in how I'm speaking. I'm using a certain voice today. for example. I don't use this voice at home very much. Okay. I use a different voice with Sam. You know, Tori. They get a different voice from Tori. You know, they get a different voice from me that I don't use in class. I'm avowing different identities in different relationships. And that those avowals vary in how salient they are to me. I have a whole bunch of identities. Well, which ones are really prominent to me? You've identified a couple of your identities. If you had to describe yourself, you would say, I am a...
mother.
Anything
servant.
Else? So mother's top of the list. That takes up a lot of room
Probably.
On your landscape. So for you, you avow, a salient avowal for you is an identity as a mother. And that one other characteristic of our avowals, in addition to their salience, is their intensity. To what degree do I feel called to defend that particular identity as a mother? Like that mothering is a worthwhile thing, is a good thing, an important thing. I think a lot of gay people in our culture feel really all over the map on this intensity thing and on the salience thing. To what degree do I want to really make my homosexuality salient? Do I want to make it a real central part of my life? Do I want to enact it in my communication so that it's obvious to people where I stand and that this is important to me? And is it an intense identity for me? Is it one that I'm going to really defend as a worthwhile identity? Or am I more ashamed of it or just not going to play it up as much? Is it just a small aspect of myself and something I have to deal with? I bring up that example just because I think people who are marginalized for whatever reason in culture really have to think a lot about these avowal issues. How much do I show about a particular identity that I may have? I bet you don't feel many restraints on showing mother, that having a mother identity in many contexts is appropriate. Although you did have an example a couple days ago.
Yeah.
About the woman at the party.
I had lots of examples. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of child care, and I always used it kind of as a litmus test, as meeting new people. I just throw out right away, well, I take care of children at home. And they would either say, oh, that's wonderful, or they'd turn and walk away. I thought, well, now I know. Now I know where I stand there.
That is nice. Well, it's nice to have that, at least to know it.
And they thought they were judging you.
Yeah, right.
So we got these two processes going on as individuals. One is we're always, in our communication, unavoidably avowing certain cultural identities. We're telling people how we want to be seen. And other people are ascribing, this is the other process, we ascribe identities to people as well. It's this constant negotiation that's going on. I'm avowing an identity today as a teacher, okay, but that's the one that's most salient to me. I don't know that I feel very intensely about defending the worthwhileness of a teaching identity. And then you are negotiating with me about the degree to which you're going to ascribe that identity.
We're letting
to
you be a teacher.
You are indeed. Yeah. And it is a matter of letting, and it's all a social process of who do I get to be with you, and that you're doing the same. You're avowing a student identity, okay, and nodding is an appropriate way to do students, and saying yeah, and, you know, smiling. And all these things are ways that we do this kind of thing. We negotiate these identities, and I just responded inappropriately, and so you're a little embarrassed because I named.
No, it's funny because it's true.
But I named the things. We don't do that in conversation. You know, I wouldn't say, oh, you nodded again, and said, oh, you know, we wouldn't do those things. We just let them happen because we're confident.
Sometimes between spouses, we do.
Yes.
What did you mean when you?
Looking
that way.
Yes, about the role of humor and witticism, either we both understand the same thing even though we're in different cultures, versus why is that funny to you? And can you explain that to me?
Well, two things. Culture or humor can be such a great, as you say, litmus test of just sort of a cultural feeler, you know, to try out something and see if somebody else thinks it's funny. And it's such a joy when you meet somebody new who thinks the same things as fun,
yes,
that are funny.
Our first date was like that. That's how we knew that we would enjoy each other. Is that
shared sense of humor?
Well, actually, I laughed at something that
we were at a play, and someone unexpectedly shot another person on the play, and Barbara let out this real gut laugh, and I thought, all right, a woman who laughs at death.
It was
not an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. It was
there was some irony.
So it wasn't like everyone else was shocked and you were laughing.
No, but I was laughing loud.
Right.
I thought
right.
It was pretty funny.
This makes a lot of sense. This explains a lot about you two.
It's the dark side that draws us together.
I hear you.
Well, with all this in mind, here I want to give four general pieces and then move on to something really specific that you can do to be an ally to people with whom you want to have relationships across cultures. One is ethnocentrism. That means being really focused on your culture as the correct way of looking at the world. Your reality is the correct reality. And that's a really difficult thing to set aside, but really an important thing to set aside if you're going to have competent intercultural contact is to recognize that your own culture colors your view of reality. Your own standpoint comes from a particular place, and that it's no more right or wrong than anyone else's standpoint. You know, the relativism argument here that would get trashed by the black and white thinkers. Yes, sir?
It's always bugged the hell out of me that the Chinese think that they're the best in the world. And it's the white man in me thinking, well, we get to think that. And it's good. We've learned better than to think that. And then we come around and
we know better. See how much
and find out they're thinking that. You know. So it's just ethnocentrism.
Someday they'll be as advanced as we are.
Ethnocentrism really sucks. And you're right. But it puts you off. It really puts you off when you meet somebody.
A second piece of advice is we often say, oh, you know, you hate a certain group until you spend some time with them, and then suddenly you are no longer holding those kinds of biases. Finding out a longtime friend is gay, for example, can change someone's attitude about homosexuals. Like, oh, Jimmy's gay? Oh. And for some people, they just can't deal with Jimmy anymore. For most people, it means, oh. But it's not as simple as that. Actually, research on contact has a whole variety of conditions that have to be in place before contact will actually lead to intercultural understanding. It's not just that you spend contact in another culture. It has to be a certain kind of contact. It has to be with certain kind of intent and certain kinds of activities. But that you can't just throw people into contact with each other and expect that it'll fix things. But here are two characteristics that are pretty easy to think about. If you can promote intercultural contact in situations that are seen as non-threatening to everybody involved, for example, you wouldn't send a man to a baby shower, for example, a traditionally female event, so that he could learn more about that culture. He would likely be an object of sort of teasing and ridicule at that kind of event. It would be he'd be an outsider, and it would be threatening to him. Or you wouldn't send a woman to a stag party. Like a pre-wedding males-only party to really understand male culture, but these aren't ways to really generate empathy for that culture.
I have an interesting example for that. About a month ago, Rich was out of town, and so was Nick. Nick was staying somewhere else. And so I went out to dinner by myself, and Tespa from our congregation, you know him from Ethiopia, came in the same restaurant and sat over in the other corner. I said, oh, Tespa, come on over and have dinner with me. And in my culture, that's a fine thing to do. In Tespa's culture, he sat across from me diagonally,
not square on.
And there was a little bit of awkwardness on his part that he was having dinner with
a married woman.
A married woman. Yeah.
Is that what it is? A married woman. Was it race or was it?
No, it was the married part. I think.
Is he married?
No, he's not. And so it was really an interest. I mean, it was not a non-threatening situation for him. And then he wasn't in church the Sunday afterwards, and I thought, oh no!
He's so ashamed.
Right, exactly. But it was definitely not the most comfortable situation. But heck, you know, here he was sitting all by himself, and you know, I never get a chance to talk to him, so it was the perfect opportunity to get to know him.
Nice. The other aspect of contact is it's got to be situations that offer genuine insights into another culture, so you wouldn't necessarily get people together to watch a show, or even a situation where, like a baby shower or a stag party, where the new kind of cultural aspects are sort of caricatured, like men go hyper-masculine for this party, women go hyper-feminine for the baby shower.
Or not.
I haven't been to one, so you know, I can't say.
I have a cousin who learned to speak Thai through his girlfriend. And boy, was he embarrassed to find out that he was speaking female Thai to men. You know, they're looking at him like, what's with this guy? Well, he didn't know that there was a difference in the way in which they spoke.
Well, funny for us.
Yeah.
Did he just give up on Thai, or did he start to learn male Thai?
No, then he had to learn the male Thai in the rest of the community.
And then deepen his voice.
Yeah.
Well, things to make up for years of doing your wrong.
Yes.
A third piece of advice is just to think of your partner, especially across cultural boundaries, as an ally, not just as a friend. But that often, when you're crossing boundaries, if that person is also thinking of you as an ally, and you are thinking of them as an ally, then you can sort of solve these problems together, which, you know, Karen, you talked about as one of the routes to friendship for you, too, is are you problem solving together? If that's a reasonable way to think about how you can get people to stay together. And that means learning to track and adapt to people's cultural identities, not just identity. But if I'm talking to Barbara and recognize that at the moment she's speaking as really prioritizing, say, a feminist identity, and then if I were if I weren't tracking that that's what was her primary avowal at the moment, I might behave incompetently with her and not support that identity in favor of some other identity that maybe is in contrast with a feminist identity sometimes. So being a person's, especially across cultures, being their friend often means being their ally and trying to figure out, well, who are they being at this moment? Which of their identities do they want supported? And do I want to do that, and can I do that? But just the first step is recognizing who you're being. Dealing with you, Rich, as pastor and then as friend and co-community member, you know, which identity are you avowing in a particular conversation? And sometimes we cue each other about which identities are doing just by the language we use. We use language characteristic to a particular role to sort of tip each other off who we think we're being at a particular time. You might swear, for example, which you wouldn't do as a pastor.
You might. Or,
not in church. Right.
Probably not.
Probably not in church. And this is really the key to competent friendship across boundaries, is that the avowed and ascribed identities in an interaction should match. That who Barbara wants to be should be the same person I'm ascribing to her, who she's hoping to be seen as. I should pick up on that and respond to it, and she'd be doing the same for me. But that's what makes for competence in intercultural friendship, is to recognize that everybody's made up of a bunch of identities. Some are more salient at different moments than others. You are a person's friend, a smart, good, competent friend, to the extent that you can figure out, well, what is Tony right now? What's he really focusing on? If I'm talking to him like a dad, and he's talking to me like a social activist, I'm not really getting it. I'm not being as good a friend as I could be, especially across boundaries. That seems to matter more across cultural boundaries than just standard friendships do. It doesn't seem to be as important in an intracultural friendship.
Really? Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because basically what you're saying...
Let me say something before I hear your question. I think that when you are across cultural boundaries, there are more obstacles. Boundaries are, in a sense, hurdles, and this notion of being an ally is more important in intercultural relationships, I think, than in intracultural relationships.
Okay, what I was going to say is that theologically, speaking, being somebody's but seeing what the person, seeing their goodness and seeing their, seeing what you perceive to be who they're really created to be, mm-hmm. is something that I would do with a friend as well as somebody from a foreign culture. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's confusing to me that it's, but yeah, I can explain.
Well, and this is a different view too. This is a social view instead of a teleological view of who you are, that you're saying who the person really is. And what I'm saying is who the person is pretending to be, who the person is acting to be, who the person wants to be seen as, that's something we do for each other. And I do believe that, like you say, we can have the kingdom of God emerge in just affirming the best in other people's identities. I mean, Tony decided he wanted to be seen as a hood, you know, and that I would affirm that. I'm not sure that I should really affirm that. Does hood make sense to you? Is this an archaic term? Remember the hoods and lions?
One of the Antonios. I actually thought about that last night. He's from Staten Island. He could do a pretty good mafioso thing.
What comes to mind, Jeff, as you say that, you have, I don't know if the phrase practice face work yet, but the whole notion of saving face is really important. That it doesn't mean we don't, in a good relationship, we also challenge each other, but there's a real sensitivity to helping the person save face, which means to let them still be who they're avowing to be, right, even if you're going to gently challenge it or something like that.
And there's just, for example, being a teacher is all about face threat. It's all about saying, you know, students, you aren't quite who you could be. But you can't say that. You know, what can you say? How can you teach students? How can you move them from one place to another? For me, the most frustrated kind of students are the students who don't need that at all, who don't need you in their own minds. They're happy with where they are. They've come from wealth. They're going back to wealth. You know, you're just this distraction between parties. So I want to share with you, since you segued us to face work, let's close with this piece today. For me, I find this to be really the most useful thing that I carry around with me day to day. It helps me in my teaching, and it certainly helps me in my relationships cross-culturally, but also, you know, intra-culturally, faces this notion that we all have these socially situated identities that we're claiming. And it's not that I'm saying, okay, I'm going to be a teacher now. We don't say it out loud. It's just we make it plain by how we're interacting with other people, how we want to be seen. And it happens moment to moment. It's a dance we do with each other. And each interaction, I've written the word ascribed. I wonder what that means. It must be ascribed. So we're negotiating these faces with each other all the time. And the desire to maintain face is thought to be universal. But that's something that happens worldwide. But what differs worldwide is that these three needs vary in what each culture really values the most. Of the three, a need for respect, for acceptance, and for autonomy, which do you think is the key in American culture? Which of those would you put at the top?
Autonomy.
Yeah, absolutely. Autonomy is the one that's most important in America. And in some of the other countries where it's the nail that sticks up that gets pounded down, the need for acceptance is absolutely at the top. But the argument is that I'm always presenting a face in conversation with other people, with another person, that presents me as someone who is competent, who is accepted, and who has some autonomy. And that it's your job as a competent interactant to at least recognize those needs and respond to them. Not necessarily always supporting them, as Rich was saying a minute ago. Sometimes, you know, you've got a kid who's really presenting herself as totally competent, but you know she's not. And so then how do you do this? And there's something called face threat. We do a lot of face threatening acts with people. Just simply by asking somebody to go get you something, you're threatening their autonomy face. It's called their autonomy needs. They were doing something else and you want to reroute them. And so, you know, they'll get their back up a little bit about that because you're threatening their autonomy.
So Jeff, it sounds like one of the things that we can do is just like I need to be aware of what face another person is presenting to me and respond appropriately, but I can also choose which face of myself I'm going to share with that person in any given moment. And so
you can be conscious about it rather than just let it happen. You'd be more intentional about it.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about some of my first graders and some of their parents. I've got some. I hate these kinds of descriptions, but I can think of a couple situations where I have low income, high social need kind of people. Mm-hmm. People who socially don't have their act together. Kid gets into trouble, parent comes in and talks with me, the teacher, the board. And one issue for me is how much weight do I put on, in a lot of situations, on authority as opposed to other ways of connecting.
Right.
And when I would talk like a mom for 2 or 3 minutes.
Even explicitly, like, say, I'm going to talk like a mom here for a minute? Do you say that?
Not say it out loud like that, but, you know, I always found it tough when I had to come in and have a conference with my kid's teacher when it wasn't the one that was scheduled. Mm-hmm. For me as a parent, that's hard. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a point of contact before we get to the conflict. And that's sort of intentional and sort of instinctive with me. To soft pedal, I'm not Frau Doctor, you know, I'm back way off and not come at him with authority first and foremost. But I can do authority too. But the first point of contact is what we share, which is a mom job. Some people would interpret that as giving up on authority.
So you're being clever about, you're trying to achieve the same aim as would be achieved by somebody exerting authority. You're doing it in a less face-threatening way by avowing the same identity that you're ascribing to this person who's come in to see you. You see her as primarily a mom. You present yourself also as a mom, knowing that she will probably affirm that identity for you. And then you've got that connection.
Struggles in common. Mm-hmm. Drawing a big circle that includes both of us before I start making the line between us.
Yeah.
Is how it feels to me.
Yeah, nice to know. This notion of face, I want to leave you with this, is that these aren't as straightforward as they seem, but often affirming one kind of need for one person can threaten another. For example, complimenting a student can be really difficult. Respecting their competence with the compliment, but at the same time, I can be implicitly threatening their autonomy, you know, and saying, do this again. Well, or for some students, the need for acceptance by their peers means they don't want to be praised. And I don't mean to be using as teacher-student examples here, but that's a really, that's a great one. And sometimes your own face wants conflict with each other, just like this. You know, I want independence, but I want interdependence. Well, I want to belong, I want to be accepted, but I want to be alone. And I want to be part of a group, I want to be able to come and go from the house when I want to. And I want you to really love me when I'm here. But those kinds of things are a challenge. But competence should include the ability of someone to successfully negotiate mutually acceptable identities and interaction. And that's the way to think about intercultural relationships. Sometimes it's just more of a challenge to figure out what is the acceptable identity in this case. Who do these people want to be, and what do they want to be seen as? And what do I want to be seen as? You don't want to sell yourself out just for the sake of making other people comfortable. But that this, for me, is a real key for helping myself and other people feel comfortable. I think of 3 or 4 different ways that I could say something with someone and figure out which of those is going to address, is going to support more of these needs for that person, which is going to help them feel and seem more competent, more connected, and more autonomous. For example, I often end up asking Tori things rather than demanding things from her, even though my intent is clearly the same. In both cases, I want her to clean her room. But I'll present it as a choice. You know, you can clean your room now, or you can clean your room in 23 minutes. You know, what would you like to do? Because the room will get clean either way, and the second, that mode of doing things is more respectful of her autonomy, and this theory says she'd be more likely to go along and feel less threatened by it. So this theory is just one nice way to think of yourself as an ally of the people who, with whom you would like to have relationships across cultural boundaries. It's meant to be kind of a general approach, but it's also meant to have a lot of flexibility built in. That's all I have. Let's go back to our Saturday, shall we?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. We do. It was really nice to have you. It was nice to have you all.